MacCast, Tuesday, May 8th, 2018. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, another week has gone by, and of course that means there is more Apple news and information to discuss. Also, some great feedback from you. Today's show is looking, we got a few news stories. There's not a lot happening in Apple news right now. And I know I say that from time to time, but it's particularly true this time of year, right as we are sitting in front of Worldwide Developer Conference, WWDC, which is coming up in June. So we kind of get this little lull in the product announcement cycle till we hear what Apple is going to show off to developers. And so there is a couple stories of interest to talk about this week. We're going to get into Apple meeting with the DMV and what that is all about. Some more information on your next iPhone and what the charger might look like, along with a few other stories related to iPhones and the latest rounds of rumors. We're getting into Apple expanding its news content. The iMac has a birthday. And then finally, HomePod might be getting some new features. That's going to round out the news for this week. And then we're going to get into some of your feedback, a little follow-up on the death of the AirPort that we talked about last week. I'm going to talk to you about a couple things that happened to me over the past week, including some things with my system and a backup thing that didn't really work for me. I'll explain what that means during this episode, and also an upgrade to a Mac Mini that I performed and how that went. And then we're going to clear up some battery health confusion stuff and also talk about a little Apple Watch issue, try to help a listener out with that. And that'll round out the show for this week. So I don't want to take any more of your time. Let's jump right in to some of the latest Apple news stories, starting off with Apple meeting with some folks from the California DMV. This information came via a public information request made by a site called Mac Reports. They obtained details about a meeting between Apple's Director of Product Integrity, Steve Kenner, and several high-ranking California Department of Motor Vehicles officials. The meeting, which was scheduled to last about 2 hours, was held at Apple's One Infinite Loop campus in Cupertino on April 2nd of this year. The specific purpose and the details of the meeting were not really revealed, but since it's the DMV, and Kenner, despite his title, does have close ties with Apple's autonomous vehicle project. His title meaning that it's a little bit vague. Product integrity, director of product integrity. What does that exactly mean? I don't know, but we know that he works with Apple's autonomous vehicle stuff. And because of those two things, we can assume that it's somehow related to Apple's autonomous vehicle system or autonomous system efforts. There were also references in a follow-up email to Kenner from the Department of Motor Vehicles that mentioned an Apple employee who was at the meeting who asked about turnaround times for something called Employee Pull Notice, or the EPN program. And that program promotes public safety through an ongoing review of driver records. And I thought, that's a little bit odd. Okay, driver records, what's going on there? Well, it's assumed that what Apple was asking about was needing to get new drivers approved for its current fleet of autonomous systems test vehicles. So Apple has a bunch of these vehicles out on the road. They need safety drivers in those vehicles, and they need those people to get certified, I guess, through this program at the DMV. So they were asking, you know, is it taking longer than normal, seeming to imply that Apple's not getting approvals quite as fast as they would like from the California DMV. So I'm sure that's something that came up in that meeting. So Apple looking to kind of expand that. You may remember that last year Apple applied with the state to certify six drivers, and they were using three modified Lexus RX 450H SUVs as test vehicle platforms. Well, a more recent report claimed that Apple now has about 45 of these vehicles out on the road with all their LiDAR sensors and stuff like that. And actually, that means that Apple now has the second largest self-driving test fleet vehicle fleet in the state of California. Apple also recently updated that fleet with newer versions of those Lexus SUVs, adding on even more advanced LiDAR and GPS hardware. So Apple continuing to advance that project. You might remember that Apple originally started researching car projects back in 2015, according to rumors. At that time, it was a project called Project Titan, or reportedly called Project Titan, and it was thought that Apple was working on some sort of Apple-branded electric vehicle, possibly to bring market, or that they might be working on a self-driving car, and that would become something that we as consumers could buy. Well, in 2016, that project reportedly went through a major reorganization and rethink, and the company has supposedly refocused on building what they're calling autonomous systems. And this is something that Tim Cook himself has said on a couple of occasions, or commented on a couple of occasions, and said, yep, we are working on autonomous systems. He never specifically tied those systems to actual cars. Who knows exactly what he means by that, but right now the focus does seem to be on vehicles for those autonomous systems. And it's unclear at this point if, when, or how Apple would actually use the technology they're developing. There was a recent rumor that Apple was planning on an in-house autonomous employee shuttle service, codenamed PAIL, for Palo Alto to Infinite Loop, but we haven't seen anything come from that. I would imagine that would be some sort of expansion of their autonomous systems testing, so kind of using it internally using themselves basically as guinea pigs for these things, and they would be shuttling employees back and forth with an autonomous shuttle, which would be still pretty cool to see. Who knows if that'll actually happen? Listeners to the MacCast know that my own personal theory is that Apple hopes to develop a car as a service program. And that would be, of course, far off in the future. But basically, the idea being that, you know, we don't all need to own vehicles. We would be able to buy a service from Apple or similar companies, and they would just have a car available that we could order up with our smartphone or our Apple Watch, have it available, come pick us up, take us where we need to go, drop us off. And then when we need to leave later, we just call up another vehicle, and you just pay a monthly fee to have access to this fleet of autonomous vehicles. So that's my own harebrained theory. I think that is where we're going in the future. But who knows? We'll see what Apple comes up with. But this week, they were meeting with the California DMV, likely to talk about expansion plans for getting more autonomous vehicles, testing vehicles on the roads. According to the Chinese social network website Weibo, Apple is looking to include a new charger with their 2018 iPhones. The understanding is that Apple is planning to update the wall charger they're going to include with your iPhone to a USB-C one that will offer faster charging and more power. And the reason they're probably doing this is it's believed that this year Apple is planning on moving to USB-C / Thunderbolt 3 support in all of their Macs, that's going to be kind of the plan moving forward, and that they want to make that compatible with what you get in your box with the iPhones. That would mean including a USB-C power adapter and a USB-C to Lightning cable in the box. Also, moving to USB-C would allow Apple to make the USB-C charger support fast charging, and the rumor says that Apple would include an 18-watt USB-C charger. Now, according to the Mac Rumor Report, that means they would have the ability to charge an iPhone from about 0 to 50% in about 30 minutes and from 0 to 80% in about an hour. So not too shabby. You can actually get that kind of fast charging today with an iPhone 8, iPhone 8 Plus, iPhone 10, or an iPad Pro, but you would need to invest quite a bit of money because you need to buy separately Apple's USB-C MacBook power adapter, which is about $50 US, and then the Lightning to USB-C cable, which would be another $25 to go with it. So you're looking at $75 to get fast charging, whereas it's believed this year we're going to get it right out of the box. So that would be pretty cool, and I think it's likely something that we'll see happen. Makatakara also claims to have some updates on the iPhone X Plus, the new larger update to the iPhone X that's expected to happen this year. They say it's going to be close in size to today's iPhone 8 Plus, despite having a much larger 6.5-inch display. And of course, that comes from losing the home button and a lot of the bezels taking on that iPhone X design. They do say that it will be about 0.2 millimeters thicker, though, to accommodate the, quote, mounting form of the rear camera. So a little bit thicker, but dimensionally about the same. The report also mentions the LCD iPhone, though they do say that's the cheaper one we've been talking about, the 6.1 inch, though they do say that the display will be 6 inches and not 6.1. In addition, they also say that the updated iPhone X's will have new front-facing cameras with larger sensors and a larger lens. And finally, they report that there will be an update to iOS 12 that will add the ability to use Face ID in landscape mode, which actually makes sense because we're expecting Face ID on future iPads, and also due to the fact that the Plus models do have a landscape home screen, or do have landscape home screen support. So if you're launching a Face ID supported app from landscape mode, you're going to want Face ID to be able to actually operate in landscape mode. So I think that's a natural progression. So no big surprise there. I think the biggest surprise is maybe a slightly smaller screen on that LCD iPhone that we've been talking about for a while. And speaking of that 6.1 inch LCD iPhone, there's a rumor that says that Apple may use a new LCD technology from LG in that display. It's something called MLCD Plus, or the LG marketing name for it, I guess, is a super bright display. What's different about it is that it uses 4 subpixels per pixel versus the 3 that Apple currently uses in their LCD design. So you have the regular pixel, which is the LCD pixel, and then there's all these subpixels. Typically, you have 3 of them, a red, green, and blue subpixel with this MLCD Plus design, you get a 4th subpixel that's white, and it allows a brightness boost to the display with the same backlight level. So you're not changing the power in the backlight, but you're getting a whiter and brighter display. So you're getting that without consuming any more power. Now, it's pure speculation, according to the report, because there has been a separate report in the past that Apple was looking to use a technology called full active LCDs that would allow them to get smaller bezels, something that would seem more in line with the recent 6.1 LCD iPhone rumors, because it is expected to take on the same design as the iPhone X with the thinner bezels and the true depth camera system. And the MLCD Plus technology would possibly not allow for that thin bezel design. So Apple obviously looking into different LCD technologies, looking for what that next generation of LCD is going to be. And we don't really know at this point what they're going to wind up with, but looks like they have a couple of options and a couple of directions, at the very least, that they're exploring, if you want to believe these rumors. And then finally, Strategy Analytics has Tim Cook's back when it comes to sales of the iPhone X. As you may know, many analysts and pundits had been critical of the iPhone X sales in the lead up to last week's quarterly results call. We talked about that call. And during that call, Tim Cook reiterated that the iPhone X was Apple's best-selling iPhone every week in the last month of the quarter, just like it was in the December quarter after the launch. Now, Strategy Analytics takes that stat even further, saying that their numbers show that the iPhone X was the world's best-selling smartphone model during the first quarter of this year. They say that Apple sold 16 million units worldwide. Not only that, they also say that the iPhone 8 and 8 Plus took the next two slots, selling 12.5 million and 8.3 million units worldwide, respectively. And oh, by the way, coming in fourth, the iPhone 7 with 5.6 million units. Now, Samsung did make the list, but not until number six with the Galaxy S9 Plus at 5.3 million units. So Apple taking the top four slots in smartphone sales globally last quarter. That's pretty impressive. And the fact that the iPhone 10 was the number one totally blows away all those concerns that, hey, the iPhone 10 is not selling well. We know a tactic that has worked well for Apple Music and gaining readers and subscribers is exclusive access, early access to albums and certain content. Well, it looks like Apple may be taking that strategy and expanding it into their news content for the Apple News app. This, according to Mac Rumors, they say that Apple has started to do deals with some publishers for access to timed exclusive video series, and they started with BuzzFeed last month or a couple weeks ago. Apple News debuted BuzzFeed's new documentary series, Future History 1968, with the first three episodes being exclusively available on Apple News before being rolled out to Facebook Watch, YouTube, Twitter, and even BuzzFeed's own app. According to BuzzFeed's head of audience development, they say that Apple paid for the rights to exclusively air the show's first three episodes before the other outlets, and also shared the ad revenue from those episodes with BuzzFeed. So they gave up a little bit to get that content. Apple also gave the episodes heavy promoting on Apple News, featuring it in the news video galleries for a full weekend, and also sent out push notifications about the shows to the followers of BuzzFeed in Apple News. BuzzFeed said the launch resulted in several hundreds of thousands of views across the three episodes. And after launching on YouTube, Facebook Watch, and Twitter, the episodes got another 110,000 views across those platforms. So sounds like it did a little bit better on Apple News, probably with that extra promotion. Who knows if it was due to the exclusivity. But it's looking like Apple is looking to do a lot more with Apple News. You may remember a couple shows back, we discussed Apple's acquisition of Texture, the all-you-can-eat magazine subscription service described as Netflix for magazines. It's believed that Apple has plans to roll this possibly into Apple News as an in-app-based subscription service. This week, Apple told Windows users of the app that they would be discontinuing the app on Windows on June 30th of this year. Now, that I saw this reported as some saying that this is Apple kind of shutting down the service and making it exclusively Apple. That's not what's going on here. What they were actually doing is just shutting down the Windows app, which I guess had been neglected for a while. The notice says it's being discontinued to, quote, keep things working smoothly, and that users can continue to access their subscriptions using compatible phones or tablets running iOS or Android, or they can also access the service on Fire HD tablets. So they're just shutting down the Windows app. Who knows long-term what Apple's plans for Texture is? It could end up being something exclusive to Apple News, but looks like they're not taking that step quite yet. But regardless, Apple is looking to do more with Apple News and expand that content. The iMac had a birthday this last Sunday. It turned 20. Sunday marked the 20th anniversary of the announcement of the original Bondi Blue iMac by Steve Jobs. It and Steve Jobs' return to Apple, I would say, were largely responsible for the massive turnaround of Apple, which was actually just 90 days from going bankrupt when Steve Jobs made that announcement. It also ushered in a few other big things for the future of computers. The death of the floppy drive, that was kind of controversial at the time, but ended up being the right thing. And it also brought the rise of USB as a standard serial connection on many PCs and Macs moving into the future. So kind of a big moment in Apple history and in our community. And the iMac continues to be an amazing machine. You know, Apple has reiterated on that little blue machine. And definitely Apple would not be where it was today without the little blue iMac. And I thought we should just note that. So happy birthday to the iMac, 20 years old as of a couple days ago. And then finally in the news for this week, a little update coming to your HomePod, it's looking like. This is something that showed up in the setup process for iOS 11.4 Beta 2, which came out this week. Anybody who's owned an HomePod knows that during the setup, one of the screens that you come across is the personal requests screen. And that asks you if you want to turn on personal requests, which would give you access to your messages, reminders, and notes on your HomePod. Now that screen has been tweaked a little bit, and it's displaying an extra icon in the little icons that are shown at the top of the window. It now shows a calendar icon. The text has not changed. It still mentions only messages, reminders, and notes specifically, but it also does and did say and more, so we can assume that maybe calendars fall into that and more category. But speculation is that Apple will be adding calendar support to the HomePod with the release of iOS 11.4, assuming it makes it through the beta process. Of course, betas features come and go. We saw that with AirPlay 2 and the stereo pairing for HomePod, so who really knows what's going on there? You know, even though the change is in the iOS beta, we can't really do any testing with it because there is no beta for the HomePod software. So even if the feature's in there, at this point, we don't know how it works and what features are supported. You know, can I have it just read back my calendar events? Can I add stuff to my calendar? Can I change things? We really don't know, but it looks like Apple is planning some calendar features in the next update for the HomePod. And speaking of iOS 11.4 beta, there's also a new security feature that popped up, and it may be in there as a direct response to the Grayshift and Cellebrite cracks for the iPhone. We've been talking about this a little bit, specifically the Grayshift one and the little gray key box, which is this box being sold to law enforcement and government agencies where they can connect an iPhone to it through the Lightning connector, and the machine will brute force, basically attack or guess at the passcode, and eventually will be able to unlock that device, in some cases in as short a period of time as a couple of hours if you just have a four-digit passcode. So what Apple has done, apparently, is they've added in iOS 11.4 something called USB restricted mode. And it requires that in order for a locked iOS device to communicate with a USB accessory through the Lightning connector, that device would have to be either unlocked when it was connected to the computer, so already unlocked, or you need to enter the device passcode while it's connected at least once a week. So if the device is left in a locked state for 7 or more days, then you can only use the USB to Lightning connector for charging at least until the device is unlocked with the passcode. So this means that boxes like the gray key would actually have to guess the unlock code before the 7-day timeout period. Now, depending on how quickly law enforcement can get the necessary authorizations to go for an unlock attempt with a device like the gray key or sending it to Cellebrite, that can take a little bit of time. And then depending upon how long the machine needs to work to try and guess the passcode, they might reach that USB lockout. And that would therefore protect the device from this kind of a brute force attack. And just for reference, with a 4-digit code, the crack can work in as quick as 2 hours. But if you use a 6-digit numeric code, it can take 3 days or longer if you want to throw in alphanumerics into that 6-digit code or make it even longer. It's going to take an even longer period of time. So really, if you want to take advantage of this USB restricted mode, you're probably going to want to consider using a longer alphanumeric passcode on your iOS devices. This is something that I switched to as soon as I heard about the Gray Key Unlock. I used to use just a 6-digit numeric code, and I've now moved to a longer alphanumeric code just to protect myself. Not that I think law enforcement is going to come in and seize my iPhone, but I more worry about this stuff getting out to the bad guys. And as a matter of fact, we did have the story last week that the Gray Key source code, some of it has leaked out and is being distributed. So it's only a matter of time before, you know, hackers and other people outside of law enforcement and the government can maybe do this kind of a crack on iPhones. And, if my iPhone gets lost or stolen, I don't want anybody getting in it or getting at my data. So that's why I made that change. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Ulysses. Ulysses is a writing application for your Mac, iPhone, or iPad, and it is an awesome one. You can use it for regular writing. I use it for Markdown. I am a big convert to Markdown. In fact, I'll be doing a talk on it at this year's MacStock Expo. I'll tell you a little bit about that at the end of the show. But for me, Ulysses is the perfect tool to write and manage my Markdown. I love it because it allows me to write very, very quickly and beautifully. It displays all of the markup in great styles, and you can totally customize those styles because they have templates and themes. You can download new templates and themes from their library and people can share them. I also appreciate the organization. It allows me to set up filters and groups so I can organize my stuff by project or task. I put everything in there. I have categories or groups for to-dos. I have a group for all of my presentations that I give to user groups or for things like MacStock. I also use it for a lot of my documentation for my programming work. So I have filters and groups in there for that. And you can easily, with Ulysses, add keywords to make your filtering and finding documents even faster and easier. So it's really great for all of those things. And if you're a writer, they have this great goal feature that is also really nice. You can set goals for the number of characters and the words, sentences, paragraphs. You can even set target reading times, and it will keep track of those for you as you're writing and let you know how close you're getting to your goal and when your goal has been reached. So I thought that was a really cool feature too. Something that I'm not using because I'm not really writing long form stuff, but if you're a blogger or a writer, that would be a great feature for you. And with Ulysses, you can access and edit all of your text anytime, anywhere, because they are completely cross-platform, Mac and iOS, and all of your texts and stuff on your devices are kept in sync via iCloud. It allows you to export to multiple formats, so text, HTML, EPUB, PDF, DocX, and again, they have that really flexible styling with support for the different templates and themes that you can download. Easy publishing to WordPress blogs and also to Medium, and it comes at a really great price. A monthly subscription, just $4.99, a yearly subscription, $39.99, and they do have discounts. If you're a student, you can get 6 months of access for $10.99. And right now, because you're a MacCast listener, you're going to get a special offer. You can use the Ulysses app for free for 3 months if you go to ulyssesapp.com/MacCast. That's ulyssesapp.com/MacCast. You can also download it for free on the App Store and the Mac App Store. There you would get a 14-day trial, but use the URL ulyssesapp.com/MacCast and you're going to get 3 months. So do that. And also, if you're a Set App user, guess what? You already have Ulysses. You need to download it and try it right now. If you're not using it, no excuse not to use it. If you're a Set App user, try it out. I know you're going to love it. If you want to get more information, see screenshots, all that great stuff, go to the Ulysses website, ulyssesapp.com, and don't forget to go to ulyssesapp.com/MacCast for your free 3-month trial. And a big thanks to Ulysses for their support of the MacCast. So I want to follow up a little bit on what we were talking about with respect to the airport and Apple discontinuing their airport lineup. We talked about maybe some of the alternatives and the fact that this isn't going to happen overnight. Apple's still going to support airports. So if you have one now, you don't need to worry too much. But I was commenting that, you know, in the future, you're going to want to think about what your next router might be. And specifically, if you have a time capsule, I mentioned that, you know, they're several years old now, depending upon when you bought yours, and they do have a spinning hard drive in them. So you might want to consider replacing that as a backup solution, maybe going with some sort of SAN solution that supports time capsule. Because as we know, hard drives, it's not a matter of are they going to fail? It's a matter of when are they going to fail? And typically, spinning hard drive is going to have a lifespan between 3 to 5 years. They can fail at any time, of course, but typically I've seen most of mine last about that long, and the time capsule's about of that age. It's in that range. So I said, hey, you know, you might want to consider replacing it now if you've had it for a while. Well, Daniel wrote in to point out that, hey, Adam, you actually can replace the hard drive inside your time capsule if you're brave and you want to. iFixit.com has a great tutorial on how to do that. So you can crack in there and replace it. And yeah, of course, if you want to do that, if you want to hold on to your time capsule and you're worried about the hard drive, certainly replace it. He also pointed out that another option is you can attach a USB drive right to the USB port on the back of your time capsule or your Airport Extreme. So you could buy a new external drive, and it's the Airport Extreme if you have the 802.11 AC model. So you have to have the latest model, but you can do that. Any time capsule will actually work for this. You can attach an external USB drive. So that's another option if you want to continue to use an airport or a time capsule for Time Machine network backups. So I thought those were some good points and great options. So thank you, Daniel, for writing in about those. He also pointed out that it's probably a pretty good time to get an airport pricing-wise because retailers and companies are going to start to kind of clear them out, right? So we might be able to get some discounts on airports. So if you're an airport fan and you want to grab one before they're totally discontinued and unavailable, you might want to start looking into that now or over the next couple months. So, you know, stock up on your airports if you want to have them for a while. I guess you could buy a bunch, right? And as one fails, just bring out one of your reserves if that's what you want to do. But I think there's some really great, as we talked about on the last show, alternatives, especially in terms of mesh systems and those sorts of things. And Apple had some recommendations along those lines. So if you missed that, go back and check out the last episode of the MacCast. One thing that we really didn't talk about, though, with respect to the airport was specifically the Airport Express and the audio streaming feature. So I got an email from Jay this week, and he said, you know, I've been using these with my iMac. I have 3 Airport Expresses, and I use them to AirPlay audio all around my house. So what am I going to do when I need to replace my Airport Express for that? Do you have recommendations? And I had to think about this a bit because I didn't off the top of my head, and then I thought, you know what? Rogue Amoeba has AirFoil, which is a great option. It'll let you turn almost any Mac, iPhone, iPod Touch, PC, Android device, Linux box, including Raspberry Pis, into an AirFoil receiver. And then you can run the AirFoil app on your Mac, and you can send audio from your Mac to any of your AirFoil receivers. And you can also send AirFoil audio to devices that support AirPlay 2. So you have a lot of options with AirFoil, and that might be something to look into. I also remember that Audio Engine had a solution, their W3 adapter. It's a USB, a pair of USB adapters, one sender and one receiver. The receiver has an auxiliary jack on the back of it, and basically you plug it in, plug your speaker into it, just like you would with your Airport Express, and then you attach the sender to whatever device you want to send audio from, typically your Mac, plug it into the USB-C port, or USB port rather, and then you can select it as an audio out source on your Mac, and then any sound on your Mac will be sent from that to the receiver. The only downside there is you are going to need one sender for each Mac or device that you want to send audio out from, and I think that you can only send from one, obviously from one Mac to the speakers at a time. And also, I don't believe it will work with your iOS devices. So it's kind of limited to just your Mac or something that you can send USB audio from. And then probably the best solution, something that I ran across that I didn't know existed, is a product called AudioCast. It's from a company called Newish. You can find it on Amazon. They run about $39 US, and it is a little AirPlay audio adapter. So it's this little puck. It has a 3.5 millimeter jack on it and then takes USB power, and you plug your speakers into it, and it is an AirPlay device. And so basically does exactly the same thing that the AirPort Express does for just audio. Obviously, it doesn't have the router capabilities that the AirPort Express does, or the bridging Wi-Fi bridging capabilities, but it does the audio portion. So that's probably your best solution. I can tell you I can't vouch for the product. I've never tried it. I just ran across it as I was doing research for the show. But at $39, it's probably worth looking into. And then finally, just for thoroughness, I will mention that Sonos is a great option for wireless audio. You can send stuff through the Sonos app, and it has support for all kinds of music services, including the music that's on your Mac or your iPhone, Apple Music, Spotify, Pandora, a bunch of other services, Amazon Audio, I believe. So Sonos is a great option. Of course, it's a little on the pricier side, and Jay did already mention in his email that he was not ready to invest in a Sonos system, so he was looking for other options that were specifically supported by AirPort. So Daniel, those are a couple options that I came across. I'm going to throw it out to you and the community also. If you know of a way to AirPlay audio to a set of speakers that isn't using an AirPort Express, something that I didn't already mention, let us know about it. Send us an email, maccast@gmail.com, and we'll share that information on future episodes. All right, I told you I have a couple of stories this week to share with you over some of my trials and tribulations with my MacBook Pro. I think I talked about this a little bit on the last episode of the MacCast, where I was having an issue where my Mac was having the fans go into like full speed mode, and I was having slowdowns. The kernel task was kicking in and eating up 500% of my processor randomly, causing the whole system to grind to a halt. And I was wondering what was going on. I tried all sorts of things. And in the end, it turned out that it simply, I think, was not cooling efficiently, and it was reacting to that. So I ended up opening up the Mac and cleaning out the dust in the vents and the fans and stuff like that, blowing all that out of there. And since doing that, that really solved my problem with overheating and basically the fans kicking in and all that stuff. So that was the solution for me. We had a couple of other solutions offered up by some MacCast listeners, and we shared those on the last episode as well. But during that whole process, I think I mentioned that I saw my batteries, and it looked like they were a little bit puffy. They were a little bit swollen. So I planned a Genius Bar appointment, and I went in. I had Apple look at my MacBook Pro, and sure enough, they said, yeah, looks like they're just starting to kind of expand. We're going to go ahead and swap those out for you, all under warranty, under AppleCare. And that was great for me. But it did mean that I was going to have to send my machine in for about 3 to 5 days, is what they told me at the Genius Bar. And if you're like me, you can't survive without your Mac for 3 to 5 days. You know, I have work to do, I have podcasts to create, I have all this stuff I need to do. And so my backup plan has always been, well, I have a Carbon Copy Cloner backup. I also have Time Machine backups. You know I'm crazy about backups. So I have all my backups, not a problem. What I'll do is I'll grab my old 13-inch MacBook Air, I will boot from my external hard drive, and I'll be up and running. I'll be able to get through the couple of days, no problem. Easy peasy, right? Well, it didn't turn out to be so simple. That's how it's worked for me mostly in the past. But this time around, I booted up from my cloned hard drive. That wasn't the problem. You know, just held down the option key, selected the carbon copy cloner drive, and sure enough, it booted right into my operating system off the external. But almost immediately after it booted up, and it did take a little bit longer to boot up, of course, because that's a spinning hard drive, USB 3 external drive that I use, and my MacBook Pro has super fast SSD. That wasn't a problem, but once I was logged into my account, things started to get really strange. I started getting massive beach balls. I could barely move the cursor around the Mac. The system turned out to be almost completely unusable, and I was baffled by this. I was like, what is going on? Has something gone wrong with my backup? I ended up trying my Super Duper clone, because I have one of each, and that didn't really change things. Was still getting beach balls and stuff like that. And what I identified ultimately as being the problem was, one, I had been spoiled by the speed of the SSD. So some of that was just, you know, running on an external spinning drive. It was a little bit slower. But the bigger issue was that my Mac and the operating system was now responding to that clone as if it was like a whole new Mac, like I had completely swapped out the hardware. And what that meant was that things like Spotlight was deciding, well, I don't have an index for this machine. I need to rebuild the Spotlight index. So it was going through my entire, you know, almost 1 terabyte hard drive and re-indexing anything and everything. And as most people know, when Spotlight is doing its indexing, that causes a huge performance slowdown on your Mac. And so that, coupled with the fact that it was a spinning drive, that was grinding it to a halt. Also, Dropbox was seeing it as a new machine, so it wanted to resync all of its stuff, or at least reanalyze everything in my Dropbox. I have a lot of stuff in my Dropbox. And then thirdly, my online backup system, Backblaze, also wanted to do comparing and indexing and resyncing of everything. So it was responding to all of this background activity that was going on my machine. And so what I realized was the way I could fix all of this was to simply turn off all of those processes. So turn off my Backblaze, turn off Dropbox, and also go in and tell Spotlight not to index the main hard drive. So I probably should have done some of this stuff, like turning off the backups, before I actually did my final clone. And that way I wouldn't have had to have done it after I booted up. But I was already in that state, so that's what I went ahead and did. As far as how to disable Spotlight indexing of that new cloned boot drive, just go into System Preferences, go under Spotlight, and then in the Privacy tab, you click the little plus icon and add your cloned volume to the Privacy section. And that means, hey, Spotlight, don't index this drive. And so that'll immediately stop the indexing. Also, the other thing I ended up doing was realizing, you know, I really should probably have an SSD cloned drive, something that's faster than that spinning drive, since I've been so spoiled by that. So I did run out and purchase a new Samsung Evo 860 1 terabyte SSD and ended up doing a carbon copy clone to that drive. And that helped a lot. That made things a lot better. But still, I had to disable the indexing and some of that other stuff to really get things going. And there was one other little issue that cropped up that I wasn't expecting and I really don't have a workaround for. And that is the App Store started giving me problems for a couple of my apps. And specifically, I had the issue with Tweetbot, my Twitter client. I tried to launch that. It opened up and it immediately quit. And then it said that I needed to reauthorize the app through the App Store. No big deal. It asked for my Apple ID and login. The problem was when I logged in, it gave me this error message saying that the system could not verify the software, basically because the hardware was different. And that was really odd. So I got Apple support on a chat, and sure enough, the guy said, yeah, you don't have this software is not being launched from your internal hard drive, so it's not linked up anymore. And so it's not going to authorize you to be able to run that software. It's almost like a licensing thing. I had never encountered or heard that before. I don't know if this is actually a thing or if he was just feeding me a line, but that's what I was experiencing. And I haven't figured out a way, or I never figured out a way around that, because what actually ended up happening and was totally ironic was that Apple's turnaround on my battery replacement was a lot faster than they had told me. So I had spent about 2 days doing this troubleshooting. So I took my Mac in on a Thursday, and by Saturday, I actually had my Mac back. I had them ship it directly back to my house. So it showed up Saturday afternoon while I was still trying to troubleshoot all of these issues. So I ended up just resetting up my original machine and was back up and running. This was despite, again, Apple telling me it was going to take 3 to 5 days. So I'm bringing this up because this might be something that some of you run into if you're in this kind of situation. And I'm also throwing it out there because I'd like to hear from the community. Have you experienced any of these things? Do you have workarounds for this stuff? Or is this just something that, you know, exclusively happened to me? I really don't know, because it's been a while since I've had to operate booted off an external cloned drive. But that was my experience, and that was going on this week. The other thing I wanted to talk to you about that was another experience I had this week was upgrading my wife's 2014 Mac Mini. I mentioned I got this SSD drive, this Samsung Evo 860 1TB drive for my crisis. And then I decided, well, now I have this SSD drive. I've been wanting to upgrade my wife's machine for a while. The problem was it had a 1TB internal drive that was almost full. It was about 75% full, and I only had a 500 GB SSD lying around, so I needed a bigger one. Ended up purchasing this one, and I thought, all right, perfect opportunity to upgrade that machine from its slow 5400 RPM spinning hard drive to something much faster. And that spinning drive, honestly, was the Achilles heel of the 2014 Mac Mini. It's a great machine otherwise, but it really did slow it down in a lot of ways, to the point where it was painfully slow on some occasions. Specifically, like, my wife has a massive photos library, and that'll just bring it to a grinding halt. So I wanted to deal with that stuff. So I grabbed my iFixit toolkit, which I love, and I got ready to crack into that box. I had the iFixit instructions in front of me, only to find out that a T6 Torx screw or Torx driver is not the same as a TR6 Torx driver, which is the screws that you need to undo in the Mac Mini. These are Torx, quote unquote, security screws. So dang Apple and their security stuff not letting you get into a Mac. You need all kinds of special tools. But no problem. I just quickly ordered from Amazon the iFixit Essential Electronics Toolkit for about $20 US, $19.99. I'll have a link to that in the show notes. Added that to my repair arsenal, and that had the TR6 and TR8 screwdrivers in it that I needed. So that arrived, and I sat down a little bit nervously to deal with dismantling this Mac Mini, because you actually have to completely, basically disassemble the entire thing. So I was worried really about potentially breaking something and getting myself in trouble. I've done it in the past with an iMac, just for the record, so I have precedent for it. My advice, if you're going to do this sort of thing, is read through the entire process once or twice, which I did. I read through the entire, you know, 20 odd steps of instructions, and I did it twice, so I knew what was involved in each step. And then I went methodically through step by step as I was actually doing it. Another big bit of advice is have something set up already to organize all of the screws and little bits that you take out, and something where you can keep them in an order, so that when you have to go back in reverse order, you know, okay, these screws go with this step, those screws and parts go with that step. It makes the process a lot less stressful. So it could be something as simple as a sheet of paper, which I've used in the past, and then I just draw circles or boxes, and then I label the steps, and I place all the screws in there. The iFixit Essentials Toolkit, though, luckily for me, had a nice little organizer built right into the lid of the case. So you could flip that over and it had little slots that you could put all of the screws into. So I put them, you know, starting left to right in the upper left corner, put them in order according to the steps, and then I could just step back through. So that made it a lot easier. The other thing, if you're cracking into a Mac Mini that you might want and is also recommended, is the Mac Mini Logic Board Removal Tool, because you basically have to push the logic board out the back of the aluminum enclosure, and it's stuck in there pretty good. So I went ahead and purchased the one from iFixit. Some people say you can get along with a piece of bent coat hanger or kind of a heavy gauge wire. And I also know that when Peter Cohen did his, and I'll link to his article on his blog about upgrading his 2014 Mac Mini, he said he was able to just kind of push the logic board out of the back of the machine with his thumbs. Although I have to say, even with the removal tool, I was a little bit worried about breaking things. It did take quite a bit of force. So it was kind of nice to have that. It was a good tool to have. So I would recommend that if you're considering doing this yourself. I will also tell you that another hairy point of the disassembly was the removal of the power supply, because it has this little twist lock mechanism where you actually twist the connector to kind of unlock the power supply and slide it out of the case. And I figured that swivel was actually kind of on a mechanism, but really, there's just a hole where the kind of wires attach to the connector, and the connector just kind of hanging loose once you turn it. So I was worried about breaking that as well, but luckily I didn't do that. So overall, I would say if you're going to do this, take your time, watch where your wires are, especially when you're unhooking things. Go slowly and carefully, follow the instructions that iFixit provides step by step. They're really, really good. And even with doing that, I'll tell you, it didn't take me that long to do this upgrade. It took me maybe 30 to 45 minutes to do the whole procedure. Once I got the hard drive in there, put it all back together, it booted up first time, so I didn't screw anything up. And I can report it is a very worthwhile upgrade if you have an older Mac Mini that's kind of slowing down. Actually, an SSD upgrade is probably the best upgrade you can do at this point for any aging Mac that feels like it's running slow. The 2014 Mac Mini feels like a brand new machine. Like, it's just completely amazing. And my wife couldn't be happier, kind of an early Mother's Day present for her. So definitely something worth doing. You don't necessarily have to do it as an internal upgrade, though. For those of you who are maybe a little faint of heart, I know and I've heard from a lot of people who end up running an external, either USB 3 or Thunderbolt SSD connected to their Mac. They just turn that into their boot drive and basically boot off of an external rather than an internal. You're going to get pretty good speed out of that. It's going to be hard pressed for a lot of people to tell the difference between an external and an internal these days. If you're putting it under benchmarks, I'm going to tell you the internal probably is going to perform a little bit better, but hey, you're not having to open up a case. You're not having to worry about breaking things. So it's another great option, another good way to go if you're in that camp. But just wanted to share my experience with you finally upgrading my 2014 Mac Mini to an SSD. With the whole iPhone battery gate, battery replacement controversy going on, we've been talking a lot recently about the batteries in our devices and our computers. It's kind of front of mind for a lot of us. And a big topic of discussion around batteries is often the question of, how can I keep my device batteries healthy? What do I need to be doing to make sure that they last as long as they possibly can and that I'm not having to pay for replacements before I should really need to? And I can tell you, there's kind of a lot of misinformation and confusion out there around what the best practices are. And I think some of it comes because historically, in the old days, we had to do certain things, and now we maybe don't have to do those things. And that information gets mixed up in a lot of articles and information that you might hear from friends or family members. And this came up this week when I got an email from Carlos, because he sent me this really great article from Popular Mechanics, and it referenced some information from Battery University and iFixit. And Battery University looks like it's a website that's just devoted to batteries and battery information. So they had done a bunch of testing and looking at different things for how to get optimal battery life out of specifically your lithium ion batteries. And so they had some information in there. And among other things, it talked about two of kind of the big myths, quote unquote myths, I think, that are holdovers from days gone by. And those two are that one, you periodically need to fully discharge. In other words, take your battery all the way down to zero and then recharge it back up. So that's something we've heard. Hey, you need to do that from time to time. Set a reminder in your calendar. Make sure you're doing that like once a month or whatever it might be. So that information is out there. The other information is that it's bad for your battery to leave it on the charger for long periods of time. So if you charge up your iPhone to 100%, don't just leave it sitting on the charger, you know, overnight or for days or hours or something like that. Same thing with maybe your computer. Don't leave it plugged into the wall all the time. That can be bad for your battery. So the first one I will tell you is holdover. This idea that you need to fully discharge your battery all the way down to zero and charge it back up. It's kind of a holdover from the days when we had nickel metal hydride batteries. Those batteries had something called memory effect. And you did have to do that to kind of get by the memory effect. So if you didn't, over time, your nickel metal hydride battery would start to not charge fully. And the way to fix it would be discharge it all the way down to zero and then charge it back up to 100%. And then you get rid of that memory effect. Today's modern lithium ion batteries don't have that. It's not something that they suffer from. To that same end, modern batteries also don't need to be quote unquote calibrated. Again, when you get a brand new device, you don't need to charge it up fully and then discharge it all the way down to zero and charge it back up again. That was something, once again, we had to do with that older battery technology. So you don't have to do that anymore. You really can feel free with modern batteries to plug them in and recharge them whenever you think they need to be recharged. And it's not the end of the world if you do need to run the battery all the way down to zero, or if you're out and about and it runs all the way down to zero and then you need to charge it back up. But it's generally a good idea to avoid doing that because, again, this study done by Battery University found out that the depth of discharge can actually go a long way to affecting the lifetime of your battery. And just so we have a reminder, the lifetime of your battery is measured in charge cycles. A typical battery is going to have a charge cycle lifespan between 500 and 1500 cycles. And what a charge cycle is that when you discharge a battery to 100% of its capacity. So if you let it run from 100% all the way down to zero, and that's one battery cycle. Now, you don't have to have a cycle happen all at once. You can actually have it happen in steps. So it can be depleted where you discharge it 25% and then charge it back up. And then when it runs down to 75% again, that is one complete cycle. So it's that total of 100% discharge over any number of charges, and that ends up counting as one cycle. So you should be able to deplete the battery 100% of its charge from between 500 to 1500 cycles before it gets to the point where it only holds about 80% of its original charge. And at that point, the battery is technically considered depleted, although a lot of people would argue, well, if I'm getting 80% of my original charge, that's still pretty decent and I can continue to use that battery. And you certainly can, but just industry-wide, that's what's considered to be depleted. And so what the study looked at was something called depth of charge and how it affects the number of charge cycles you get from a battery, which therefore would determine the life of the battery, right? And what they discovered was that Repeatedly fully discharging and recharging your battery can actually shorten the number of total cycles that you can get. The study found that it can degrade that to about 70% of its original capacity in just 300 to 500 cycles. So if you're constantly discharging all the way down to zero and charging back up, they're saying that's ultimately bad for your battery life. You want to not do that. You want to avoid doing that. And I think this is actually one of the reasons why Apple does ask you and remind you to plug your device back in at 20%. You know, so when your battery gets down to 20%, right, you get that notification, hey, your battery's getting low, you probably want to plug in. And you get that again at 10%. I think that's Apple's way of saying, hey, don't let this thing go all the way down. Plug it in now and get it back up. It's also worth noting that I'm pretty sure Apple actually stops the, you know, turns off your device before it gets all the way down to true zero. I think it gets close to zero, but I think they leave a little bit of charge in there, again, to protect the battery from this shorter lifespan. So I don't think we have to worry about it too much, but in general, when your battery's getting low, 20% to 10%, it's probably time to plug it in and get it charged back up. And that's going to help keep your battery lifespan where it needs to be. So just a note on that. And that was something that came out of this piece. The second item, this deal about leaving it on the charger all the time, that's really not an issue because devices, batteries, and chargers these days should have some advanced circuitry in them, and also the operating system and the software is tuned to actually manage that situation. So with your iPhone, for example, it's going to charge quickly from zero to about 80%, and then what Apple does and what the chips and software and the circuitry in there in your battery and stuff does is then slows that process down until it gets to 100%. So it goes really fast up to 80, and then it kind of what they call trickle charges up to 100%. And then when it hits 100%, that circuitry also tells it, hey, stop charging. We don't need to charge anymore. And it does this even when it's plugged in. So it's not going to keep, you know, charging and pushing it up at that 100%. It's actually going to stop. Then the juice is going to drain out a little bit, as you might imagine, and it will simply top it up again. So even when that little green light is on your charger showing, hey, I'm at 100%, it's actually stopped charging at that point. And it's doing this kind of thing where it lets it come down a little bit, charges it back up to 100, come down a little bit, charges it back to 100. So it's going to keep it from being overcharged and causing any damage to your device. But this is exactly why you want to be careful with third-party batteries and charging accessories, because that circuitry may or may not be as advanced or as good. It might not work as well with the operating system. So, you know, when in doubt, I would say you want to go with Apple OEM batteries or at least a pretty reputable and known supplier in the Apple community. And if you're buying charging accessories, chargers and things like that, you want to make sure that they are certified by Apple. They're, you know, made for iPhone certified or certified to work with your Mac. And as far as Mac chargers go, I think only Apple chargers are really truly certified to work with your Mac. So you're probably going to have to buy or want to buy an Apple charger in that case. But for iPhone chargers and stuff like that, make sure it has that made for iPhone certification. And especially if you're buying third-party batteries, you want to be careful about what you're buying. And that's because, you know, you want to have the circuitry that keeps things in check and good. So just be aware of that. And, you know, as far as leaving your device always plugged in, you know, despite this report, I still am of the mind that it's a good idea to occasionally disconnect your Mac from power, you know, not have it always plugged in 24/7, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. If you're doing that, then I would ask, why didn't you just buy a desktop, right? You don't need a thing with a battery because you're never taking it out and about. I think it's good to run the electrons through the battery every once in a while and let it discharge a little bit and charge back up. Do you have to do it? No, but I just feel like it's something probably worth doing. Batteries were made to be used, not set, you know, not sit there being 100% charged and unused. But, you know, that's just my opinion. I don't know that there's any empirical evidence to prove that that's a good thing. And then, you know, probably the most important factor in keeping your batteries healthy is actually keeping them cool. You don't want them getting hot. The ideal temperature for your battery is between 62 and 72 degrees Fahrenheit. And you definitely want to avoid high temperatures above 95 and even below 32. Although I'll tell you, heat is the worst thing you can do to a lithium ion battery. If it's getting hot or it operates in a hot environment a lot, you are going to get a shorter lifespan out of that battery. Just be aware of that. Is it going to, you know, be really bad? No, but you might get more toward the 500 charge cycles versus maybe the 1500 charge cycles. One of the reasons why I think, you know, me being in San Diego and California, it gets pretty warm here. My batteries tend to last between 2 to 3 years. I've never really looked at the charge cycles, but I know every 2 to 3 years, I probably need to get an updated battery. And that goes for my iPhones or my Macs. iPhones are even worse because you're out and about, right? You have them in your pocket. The other thing is that, and this is nothing we can do, our devices just get hot. Like, you know, my MacBook Pro at certain times when I'm doing certain processes, that gets hot. And you know that's heating up the batteries inside there. Same thing with your iPhone, right? Depending upon what you're doing, the type of case you have on it. Apple even recommends sometimes that if you do have a case on your iPhone and it gets hot when you're charging, that you remove the case so it can actually dissipate that heat a little bit better and better protect the battery. So, you know, unfortunately, with them being soldered in the device, there's not much we can do about that, especially if the device is getting hot. And ironically, you know, everybody loves wireless charging, but guess what? Wireless chargers, they actually get hot too. They generate heat. A lot of them actually have fans and things in them to keep them cooler. And sure enough, your phone contacts that little charging pad, so it's transferring heat right into the back of your phone, right into your battery. So another reason why, hey, maybe you still want to do charging with the Lightning connector versus through a wireless charger. But I have to admit, I do like my wireless chargers now. I know I was skeptical about it in the past, but they're pretty neat things. So there you go. Last bit of good bit of advice on batteries has to do with storage. If you're going to store an item that has a lithium ion battery in it for a long period of time, you want to make sure you discharge it down to about 50%. Don't discharge it all of the way, because that's actually the worst thing you can do for a battery, is store it in a totally depleted state. If you do that, the battery chemistry is going to start to break down, and that's when you get kind of that puffy battery situation. So put it at about 50% charge, and every 6 months or so, if you're storing it for longer than 6 months, you're going to want to go back and make sure you charge it back up to around 50%, because just sitting there, it will slowly deplete over time. So if it sits there long enough, you're going to have to charge it back up. And again, related to that, store it in a cool, dry place. Avoid heat. So, you know, long-term storage in your garage or attic, probably not such a great thing. You know, keep it. It wants to be anywhere where you're comfortable. Same thing for just operating your devices. If you're not comfortable, your devices aren't comfortable in terms of the temperature. So something to note. And speaking of batteries and wireless charging, I did receive a great comment and a product recommendation from Don this week. So here's what Don had to say about his batteries and wireless charging.
Hi, Adam. Don Cornelius here, longtime listener. And I wanted to comment on wireless charging after hearing you say you had no interest in wireless charging. I was right there with you until I found out about phone stands. I did not care about wireless charging as an iPhone 7 user. As an iPhone 10 user, I found it far more interesting because phone stands, the form factor seems to have done it for me. What I ended up doing was getting a Cineo and an Anker charger. The Cineo charger is only a 5-watt charger. I take that one to work because it's cheaper and there's less money to lose if something happens at work. The Anker charger is a very nice looking stand and also charges at 7.5 watts and has a built-in fan to keep the stand cool. And I really enjoy that one and I keep that one at home. So the form factor really did it for me. But one other thing that's really working for me is the use of the iPhone 10 on the phone stand, because now when I get notifications on my phone, the notifications come in hidden, and they don't unlock until Face ID triggers. So all I have to do to see my notifications is turn my head. The notifications show up because Face ID recognizes my face. I read the notifications, and then I turn away. As soon as I turn away, the iPhone 10 has noticed that I'm no longer paying attention to it and darkens the screen again. So it's a very nice workflow. So even when Face ID is not being 100% reliable, I still find it very, very nice. So form factor for the difference in wireless charging and iPhone 10, it's been a real win. Thanks.
Hey, Don, as I mentioned earlier, I am with you on the I am a wireless charging convert camp. As a matter of fact, I actually have two of the Anker PowerPort wireless 5-watt chargers in my house. I got them on Amazon for about $17 a piece, and I just couldn't pass up the deal to try out wireless charging, and I found them very convenient. I have one in my office and one in the bedroom, but these are just the little puck ones that you put it flat on the desk. And I had been curious about some of the stand options for the specific reason that you're mentioning, because that is a problem with the puck ones that I have, is when I do get a notification, if I want to see what that is, I do have to pick up the phone, lift it off my desk, and actually look at it to get it to unlock so that I can read that notification. So I'm assuming, because you didn't mention in there, that you have the Anker PowerWave 7.5 stand. And I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. It looks like it sells for about $50 US. So not inexpensive, but it does include the stand, the cable, and the AC wall charger. And as you mentioned, it does have the fan in there, which deals with some of the heat issues that could potentially affect your battery, the stuff that I was mentioning earlier when we were talking about batteries. So that's a good thing as well. I'd be curious to know how noisy that fan is. Does it get a little bit loud or not? I might just have to buy one and try it out myself. It certainly would be very nice to be able to unlock those notifications just by simply glancing over at the phone. The only other comment I'll tell people on that is that the optimal distance for Face ID to work is between 10 to 20 inches. So that stand is going to need to be positioned on your desk or wherever it might be within 20 inches of where your face is to probably work reliably. So just be aware of that if you are going to go with this option. But you're right, there are some great stand, you know, wireless stand options. And I also went wireless in my car. I think I mentioned as my thing of the moment, either last episode or the episode before, that I love my iAudi wireless vent mount charger that I now got for the car. So I can just simply drop my phone into it, one-handed operation, it clicks in, and away it's charging. I don't have to plug in any cable when I get in the car. It's nice to be able to hop in and out without having to plug or unplug a cable. And I know a lot of cars are moving to having wireless charging built right into the consoles and stuff like that. So it's great that we're at the age of wireless charging on our iOS devices. I expect it to be the path that Apple takes moving forward with a lot of stuff. And it's great that we have great options like the Anker PowerWave 7.5 wireless charging stand. So thanks for sending in that audio comment to share your opinions with us. And if you have similar opinions and you want to share audio comments with us, as always, we welcome those, maccast@gmail.com. And speaking of audio questions and comments, finally this week we have Mitch. He has run into a little issue with his Apple Watch and unlocking his Mac.
Hi, Adam. This is Mitch from Winston-Salem. I was calling about a question I had regarding my Apple Watch unlocking my Mac. I have the Series 3 Apple Watch and last year's iMac 5K. Both are on the latest software. I have an iPhone 10 on the latest software. But really, for months and months, my Apple Watch will not unlock my iMac. And I've tried multiple things and Google searches, etc. I have, you know, deselected Bluetooth on the Mac, reselected it. I've toggle on and off the Bluetooth unlocking Mac or the Apple Watch unlocking Mac setting, on the Mac itself. I've called Apple support and really not getting anywhere. The interesting thing, and maybe this is what will send a light bulb off in your head or maybe one of your listeners, is the fact that it will work one time. Every time I do a software update on the Mac, even if it's a dot update, a point update, the first time I bring my Apple Watch in proximity to the Mac, it will log me in. But then after that, it won't do it again until I update the software again. So there's something software-wise going on that I don't understand. The next step from Apple support would be to basically wipe my phone and watch and reinstall the software, which I really don't want to do because it's a pain, and I don't think that would solve the problem. But I'm not sure what else to do. Another option I saw that I'm hesitant to do as well is to log out of iCloud on everything and then log back in on Sequence. When I start that, I get this message on my Mac that is kind of scary. The reason it's scary is I don't have much space on my Mac, so I have everything on iCloud, and I'm worried if I log out, I'm going to lose data. So that concerns me. To log out is going to really be a more laborious process than it sounds like it should be. But if you think that would be the way to do it, and that it'll be reasonably safe, I'll go ahead and proceed. Anyway, thanks so much for your help with this. I really appreciate it. I appreciate your podcast every week, and I learn a lot from it. So keep up the good work. Thanks so much.
Hey, Mitch, I know what you mean about those scary messages from iCloud when you attempt to turn iCloud off. We'll see if we can help you out here. I don't know that I have many more answers than you've already kind of gone over. It sounds like you've tried everything before maybe moving to those last resorts of either turning off iCloud or actually reinstalling your operating system. The reality is that you should have no problem turning off iCloud. It should never actually remove your data from the iCloud servers, at least not unless you specifically ask it to. Usually what it's going to do is just remove or ask you if you want to remove the local copies of that data on your device. So it should only remove them from the device. And the reason for that is if you have other devices syncing from iCloud, you don't want to mess those up, right? So just turning off iCloud shouldn't cause data on the other devices that are syncing to your iCloud data to suddenly, you know, disappear or get lost. So it shouldn't do that. I would always advise before doing anything like that you have a full backup of all that data somewhere that's not in iCloud, because I frankly don't trust the cloud at the end of the day to keep my data safe, right? I think Apple does a great job, and I think iCloud's probably perfectly fine, but again, that's totally out of my control, and I don't like any of my data being totally out of my control. But that said, it shouldn't be a problem. If you read those messages very, very carefully and kind of think about what they're saying to you, they don't end up being quite as scary. But I know that reaction. You see, it'll say something like, we're going to remove all your data. And that just that statement alone is purely frightening to most people. So the reality is, though, I'm not sure you're at the point where you need to log out of all of your iCloud accounts yet. As far as wiping and reinstalling iOS, maybe that might help. Again, I agree it's kind of a pain, but it's really not that bad, especially if you do an encrypted backup via iTunes. So connect your device to your Mac using the Lightning to USB cable, go into iTunes and do a manual backup, and make sure you check the option to encrypt that backup. And the reason you want to encrypt it is because when you do that, it will save things like all of your network settings and passwords and stuff like that. It'll also save all of your health data if that's something that you sync to your phone, and that stuff will be able to get restored back. If it's not encrypted, that data will have to be re-entered. And I know with the health data, you can lose some of your health data history. So definitely do that if you're going to go down that route. About the worst thing that happens when wiping and reinstalling the operating system, iOS these days, is one, it has to re-download all of your applications from the App Store. That's not that big a deal. The other one that really bothers me all the time is having to reset up all my Apple Pay cards, which, again, it's kind of a hassle. But for security reasons, those things aren't backed up and they're not restored. So you have to kind of start over. But once again, I still don't think you're at that point yet. From everything you're telling me, I think it sounds like it could be Mac OS related, something related to the operating system. So I'd almost say, you know, like maybe you want to back up your operating system and reinstall that from scratch. But I think that's an absolute last resort. It could just be some sort of bug in High Sierra. I'm assuming you're running High Sierra since you said you're on the latest operating system. But what you might consider, again, because I think it might be a Mac OS related issue, is doing an over-the-top installation of the very latest Mac OS High Sierra combo updater from Apple's support website. So if you go to support.apple.com/downloads, you can find what's called the combo updater, which is basically all of the latest updates for the operating system, and you can download and run that installer right over the top of your existing installer. And if you have any corruptions or any weird things going on with the core system files, that should resolve any issues related to that. So it's a good general tip for troubleshooting before you get to those kind of last resort steps. So I'd give that a try. Another thing I would also try, if you haven't already, is try booting into safe mode. Holding down the shift key when you boot your Mac, that will put it into safe mode. And what that means is it's only going to run and install the use the kind of default Mac OS system extensions and software and stuff like that. None of your third-party extensions or any weird stuff is going to run. It's like running a clean version of the operating system without a lot of extra stuff that you may have installed from third-party apps, and see if that resolves the issue. If that does, if you can reliably in that mode unlock your Mac using your Apple Watch, then that might indicate that there's some sort of conflict with maybe a third-party app or third-party software that's running on your machine. I would guess if that turns out to be the case that it's something related to maybe a third-party Bluetooth device like a mouse or a keyboard that has its own drivers or its own software. But that's just thinking off the top of my head, not really knowing what your system setup is. So that might be something worth trying again before you move to those last resort steps. But I would almost say start with the Mac operating system, since you indicate that every time you do a software update, it kind of works again, at least for one shot. So I don't really know. It does sound like a weird problem. Finally, I guess we'll throw it out to you in the community. Have you encountered a similar situation to Mitch? And if so, how did you resolve it? If you did, let us know. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to talk about some upcoming events that I am going to be at, or an upcoming event, and that is the MacStock Conference in Woodstock, Illinois. I'm going to be speaking there this year. I'm going to be giving a talk on Markdown. It's called The Power of Text. This is a great event for the Mac community. If you've never been and you happen to be in the area, or you're willing to fly into Chicago, basically it's just right outside Chicago, Illinois. It's well worth going to. Bob Levitis is going to be the keynote speaker this year. Other presenters, Gene McDonald, Chuck Joyner, Kelly Gamont, David Ginsburg, Tim Robertson, Allison Sheridan, Mike Schmidt, Brett Terpstra, they're all going to be there presenting. I mean, these are really great speakers, and it's a really great conference. It is affordable. They still have tickets available. And guess what? As a MacCast listener, you can get $70 off the conference ticket right now if you use the code MacCast. So use the code MacCast, get 70% off, and I hope to see you at MacStock Expo or MacStock Conference 2018 And if you do end up going or you are planning on going, let me know. Shoot me an email. And also, while you're there, make sure you come up and say hi. I love meeting and talking to MacCast listeners at conferences and stuff like that. So that conference, oh, I forgot to tell you when it is. The conference is set for, and my browser just failed me, July 21st and 22nd in Woodstock, Illinois. So there you go. Hope to see you at MacStock Expo. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode. Before I leave you, let me take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great software by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You'll find them at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have questions, comments, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on social media, you'll find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.